And, a lot of times men will try to evaluate sexual addiction based upon kind of the extreme nature of the acting out. I often hear men say, well, I've only done this or I just did this. And what we want men to understand is it's not about what you do, it's about why you do it. What is the driving factor?
Faithful and True podcast. On today's show, we have a special conversation that we'd like to feature with Elizabeth Griffin from the Faithful and True staff. Elizabeth, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, Randy?
You're doing just great. And as always, we have our host, Dr. Greg Miller, with us. Greg, we're excited to have Elizabeth with us today, aren't we?
Absolutely. And really, this is a continuation of a conversation that we began several months ago about this idea of, is sex addiction a real thing? And there's a lot of conversation in our culture and particularly around the professional counseling world of what is sex addiction? Is it something that is diagnosable? And so today we want to continue that conversation and look specifically at men who have affairs exclusively. One of the things that can happen as a man will come to our workshop and, he'll basically say, I don't know if I belong here. All I've had is affairs, or I've just had one affair. And so I want to continue the conversation to maybe help someone to understand, is it possible for me to have an affair and not be a sex addict? And if I've had an affair, what are some of the things I should be looking at if I'm going to consider myself a sex addict? And so that's kind of where we're going to start. And so one of the things I'd like to bring into it is we also talk about at the Faithful and True Men of Valor workshop that you can be a relationship addict as well as a sex addict. And so what would you say if you're working or talking to a man, Elizabeth, what would be the distinguishing circumstances or attributes that you would be looking for that might help you to distinguish if someone is an addict who is having affairs versus someone who's not?
So, well, if you think about the criteria, well, let me start with that. I think sexuality is often on a continuum. And at one end, we have healthy sexuality, then maybe misuse of your sexuality, abuse of your sexuality, and addiction. And so someone can fall, anywhere along that continuum. I think for people who truly are engaged in affairs that is addictive, I think oftentimes you see a pattern of that behavior. So it's more than just one affair in 20 years. It's often multiple affairs, maybe even in a year, or multiple affair partners, not just one affair partner, but several affairs occurring at the same time. When you look at the criteria for addictive behavior, it really is the amount of time that you engage in the behavior interferes with important aspects of your life, your professional life, your leisure life, your educational life. It's also repetitively engaging in sexual behaviors, fantasies or urges in relationship to a mood because you're depressed, anxious, or even happy, or in relationship to stressful events, or you're repeatedly engaging in the behavior despite all the harmful consequences. Now, you can have one affair and still experience those. But typically, if you don't have that addictive component, that's going to start to dissipate fairly quickly, that you're going to one day go, what am I doing? Why am I doing this and risking my marriage, my professional life, all these consequences? And so then that becomes the piece that it feels like, okay, I can stop this. I think for men who engage in affairs that it's more addiction-like, they often feel like they can't stop. Mm-hmm. They often feel like I have no control over this, and it feels more impulsive versus someone who engaged in an affair, still problematic, but at some point can step back and go, this is not the man I want to be. Mm-hmm. Versus the addict can kind of say that, but they can never get out of that loop of looking for another affair partner. Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a great way that you said it, that idea that kind of the language that we use is on my own, I've been unable to stop. So both men, you know, the person that may be struggling with addiction and the one that's not, will look at the destructive nature of the affair, will begin to see that it's taking a toll on his marriage and his family. And the person maybe not struggling with addiction can see that evidence and determine on his own he's not going to do it anymore and stop. The person with addictive energy, on their own, they're not able to stop because there are these other factors that are driving it that are contributing to the behavior itself. And one other thing that we would identify is I've worked with men that would say, oh, I've only had one affair. Well, the problem is, yes, they've only had one affair, but leading up to that one affair, there's been use of pornography. There's been some other sexual acting out. There might have even been compulsive masturbation. So that addictive energy was already present prior to the affair occurring, and the affair was maybe just a manifestation of that addiction energy culminating in the affair itself.
Right. So they often, I say, travel around with the behaviors. So, you know, that may be pornography use, compulsive masturbation, affairs, and maybe strip club, you know. And so you can convince yourself, well, I am changing because I'm not engaging in the same behavior. But underneath, you're right, there's that addictive energy or personality that comes to the surface. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I mentioned is this idea of many men will say, you know what, yes, I've had many affairs, and the sexual part of it was not that important, or it wasn't a driving factor. And that possibly could be true. But what is also true is the addiction energy is about the relationship. That, you know, we believe that an addiction occurs anytime I'm trying to meet a legitimate need in an illegitimate way in a repetitive pattern. Well, I can bring addiction energy to a relationship. And so I engage in a relationship, and maybe it's sexual, maybe it's not. But the reality is I want that relationship to rescue me. I'm fantasizing about that relationship. And so in the context of my marriage, it's unhealthy. And in the context of my own addiction energy, I'm bringing it, even though it may not be sexual, I'm bringing addictive energy to the idea of being in a relationship.
And I think also it has that component that when you're in that kind of relationship, even if it's an emotional affair, you get that high, you get that adrenaline rush, you get that excitement, you start to forgo commitments to your marriage, to your work, in order to have that. And so while I think, you know, some people will say, well, I didn't cross the flesh line, therefore it wasn't as destructive. Well, there may be some truth to that. Mm-hmm. And it is still very much an addictive pattern that you're just as addicted to the high of that contact, waiting for that text to come in, getting that phone call, getting that email. And so it ends up being very much like an addiction, even though you haven't crossed over into actual sexual contact.
Right. And, you know, a lot of times men will try to evaluate sexual addiction based upon kind of the extreme nature of the acting out. You know, I often hear men say, well, I've only done this, or I just did this. And what we want men to understand is it's not about what you do, it's about why you do it. What is the driving factor? And, you know, typically we don't understand, you know, stereotypically, men in this context, but one of the things that can be true is that men have an addiction to the energy of romance or infatuation. You know, they have a series of these relationships, and for them, the best part, the most exciting part is the beginning part. It's that
the chase. It's it is. It's like, can I get this person to adore me and love me? And it's the result of not feeling like you can give that to yourself or get mm-hmm. that from other people in your life.
Right. Well, and it's that idea of, I want this person to rescue me from my insecurities, my fears, my loneliness. And so I engage in this energetic, excited relationship, the rush and the euphoria of infatuation that lasts for a little bit, but eventually that will diminish. The relationship may or may not be sexual, but the idea is, what I'm drawn towards is the neurochemistry of infatuation. And when that fades, then I go looking for the next one. So again, it's not just what I'm doing, but am I bringing this addiction energy? I want this thing to rescue me, whether it's a one-time relationship or an ongoing relationship. I think another indicator about the addiction energy is if I have several affairs that are going on simultaneously, where, again, I'm in one relationship, whatever I'm wanting that relationship to do for me, it's not able to do it. So I start looking for other relationships.
And I think some people will either kind of stagger it to always have that feeling, that initial in love feeling. So mm-hmm. when one affair partner, it starts to hit more reality that, you know, my goodness, this person makes demands on me or needs things from me, then look for that new person who's going to love me and adore me and going to think I'm wonderful. And so there's always someone in your life who gives you that initial high that neurochemically we all get when we first fall in love with someone.
Sounds exhausting.
It is.
And it is. And that is exactly, you know, what people will start to experience. And Greg, I think it's just, you know, so important that I think women in our society, it's written about, you know, that women are relationship addicts. And however, I have found that it's just the same for men. Mm-hmm. We all want to meet those seven desires in our life, to be heard and understood, to be blessed, to be touched. And we, if we don't know how to get those in our relationship with God, in our relationship with ourselves, then we'll start looking for other people to meet that need. And I don't think that's about men or women. I think that's about being human.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one other thing that can be true, the men that we work with, maybe the situation is, I've been married for 5 years. I've only had one affair. Therefore, am I an addict? Well, part of it is understanding the story and the history, because what may be true is, prior to getting married, I was promiscuous and I had many sexual partners. They were all consensual. I wasn't married, so I wasn't betraying any of the vows. And so I get married and I'm able to maybe contain the addiction for a season, but then eventually it manifests itself again at some point. And so when I'm talking to a man and he's wanting to evaluate, you know, am I an addict? Part of the work is to fully understand my sexual story, beginning with those early experiences of being exposed to pornography or even some experimentation. And how has that played out in all of my life, not just in the season when I've been married?
And I think if we really look to the research would say that truly addiction behavior typically begins in adolescence or young adulthood. And so I think it's rare to find someone who's truly an addict who doesn't have some of those underpinnings that, if you start to look for them, start to surface. And then I would say also that sometimes, you know, people say, I don't know, I need to find out, am I an addict or not? And, you know, my take often is, well, we don't know yet, but we know your behavior is problematic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That you are engaging in behavior that's not congruent with who you want to be. And so therefore, we can start to tease that out over time, but the behavior is problematic. And in many ways, we're still going to treat it the same. You know, we're still, and it may be a little bit more difficult to treat if you truly fall at the addiction end of the continuum, but we're still going to do many of the same things, because I think when it's all said and done, it's about an intimacy disorder. Mm-hmm. And it may be about an intimacy disorder that's been with you longer than just what you've engaged in, or it may be about an intimacy disorder that you're just starting to recognize, you know. But I think when it's all said and done, a lot of the treatment's going to look the same.
Right. And again, you know, if addiction is trying to meet a legitimate need in an illegitimate way in a repetitive pattern, well, then recovery is doing the work of identifying the legitimate need and meeting it legitimately, you know, because behind all of the addictive energy is this legitimate need that continues to go unmet. And as you've identified, a big part of that is intimacy. You know, God created us to be intimate. That's part of our DNA. And the way that I talk about intimacy is when I'm known, I'm safe, and I'm connected. And one of the things that we know is if I'm in a relationship that is outside of my marriage, if I'm in a relationship, whether it's sexual or not sexual, and it's not supporting my marriage, and in fact, it's taking away from my marriage, then the intimacy that I desire is never going to be realized. Mm-hmm. I have to acknowledge that, you know, the intimacy that I need is best going to be met in the marriage that I have, if both people are willing to work on that.
Got it. The other thing I would just add to this discussion is that I think there are people who are truly at the far end of the continuum in the addiction category, and it has been, the behavior's been going on for so long, their brain chemistry is now a mess. And I think it's important that people eventually who are in that category realize that they may need medication to help them get the behavior under control. Mm-hmm. Because there are some people that just cannot stop their sexual behavior without the medication to kind of get their brain chemistry back to a place where they feel like they have more control over it. Well, and men are often reluctant to talk about medication or feel like I got to do this on my own, you know.
Right. Well, and it makes perfect sense. I often heard Mark Laser talk about this idea of we have to get our brains to cooperate. And if I'm, you know, kind of neurochemically wired towards depression or anxiety, and then I have intensified that over the years through my chaotic acting out behavior, then, like you said, I may need some support that can come through a variety of different means, but to start to create balance again in a system that has been so out of balance for so long.
Mm-hmm. I talk about it like we need to calm your brain mm-hmm. back down to normal levels. And for some men who've engaged in this behavior for years and years, they have no idea what that looks like.
If you were talking to someone, and, you know, they're trying to assess, is this, again, and I'll just say it now, here at Faithful and True, it's not our goal or agenda to try to convince somebody that they're an addict. But let's say that somebody is trying to find their place on the continuum. Are there some questions that can be helpful for them to consider and to reflect on that may begin to point them in the right direction?
Well, I think the first question to ask yourself is, have you tried to stop? Mm. And what has that looked like? Have you been successful for extended periods of time? Also, when did the behavior begin? And you're right, not just the behavior they're engaging in, but when did your sexual behavior start to feel out of control or unmanageable? Or did you have a substance use issue? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes people, their addictive behaviors will travel. So they may come to us and be engaged in problematic sexual behavior, but then we start hearing, well, 2 years ago, they were gambling and at the casino every night. And 5 years ago, they had a cocaine problem. And so I think looking at your history, have you engaged in other addictive behaviors, maybe even addictive behaviors that have been healthier. I see a lot of men who had a period of their life, they were running triathlons and they were working out 5 hours a day, or men who are working 12 hours a day. So, you know, really looking, do we see parts of your life that look uncontrolled and unmanageable that you were trying to control and could not. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that it, being able to look back on your life and create a history is really helpful at times.
You know, one thing, you know, the saying of AA, it's not that we couldn't stop, it's that we couldn't stay stopped.
Right.
And I like how you said, you know, you added that for an extended period of time, was I able to walk away from this behavior? And what's interesting, you can hear the stories of someone who for 2 years contained the behavior, but it was still formulating, it was still growing underneath the surface. And then this is just the latest expression of that addictive energy.
Or they were able to contain the behavior, but that personality of being angry all the time, being irritated all the time, like they were, I always talk about it, it's white knuckling it. Mm-hmm. And for 2 years, you contain the behavior, but you were also this individual no one wanted to be around, and you right. had no inner peace. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I like to look not just at the behavior, but look at what is your mood state when you are not acting out. Right. And if that mood state is depression, anxiety, irritability, inability to connect with others, then you may have stopped the behavior, but you still have that underlying addictive energy that you're just white knuckling it, hoping that it doesn't leak out.
Mm-hmm. Again, it's kind of the AA understanding of the dry drunk.
Yes.
And we absolutely see the dry drunk in, you know, the work that we do with men who struggle with sexual addiction. And there's another idea that I talk about, secondhand smoke in our addiction, where we're going through a season where we're wanting to give up the behavior, we're wanting to be sober, and yet we're not fully engaged in a recovery process. And so what happens is, it's kind of like I'm the person trying to give up smoking, and I'm not buying cigarettes, I'm not smoking cigarettes, but I'm wanting to go stand next to the people who are, so I can get a whiff of their secondhand smoke. And there's a lot of expressions of that in sex addiction where I'm not fully acting out. I haven't lost my sobriety, but I'm finding myself and I'm positioning myself close enough to experiences or memories or associations that give me a whiff of that secondhand smoke. And I often say, if you spend enough time standing next to the smoker, eventually you will become the smoker again. So it's not just about what I'm doing, but it's how close am I getting to it, and what's going on internally when I'm not doing it.
I often think about that that's like part of the grieving process. I think when you have people give up the behavior, that has brought them a lot of comfort over the years. Mm-hmm. Part of that process is kind of bargaining. You know, can I bargain with the behavior enough that I can get little pieces of it without totally giving it up? Mm-hmm. And I love the analogy of the secondhand smoke. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to do this little piece, and it won't get me in trouble, and I will still keep my sobriety. But you're really trying to bargain and figure out, what can I keep so I can have just a little bit of that mm-hmm. juice in my life. Right. And you're right. Ultimately, that's going to lead you down a slippery slope, most likely back to the behavior if you're not careful.
Yeah. You know, one other thing just for us to acknowledge as we're talking about this, and that is the role that technology plays now in providing opportunities for affairs. You know, there was a time when the internet didn't exist. And so affairs occurred through interaction with individuals. There could be a process of developing the relationship, grooming the person, and there could be a high investment in that. But now with technology, I have an entry point into affairs that really cost me very little on the, you know, front end, even though the back end cost is huge. And I often heard Mark say to a man, you're just an affair waiting to happen. All of the pieces are there. All of the components are there. And now what has happened with technology and apps, the entry point has now been created so that if I'm that person just waiting to have an affair and now I have the entry point into the room, my vulnerability intensifies significantly.
And just being in the online world creates more vulnerabilities for all of us for boundaries to collapse, mm-hmm. because it's so easy that it doesn't feel like there's anything wrong with this. It feels like we're all anonymous, even though we know each other. It still mm-hmm. feels like I'm sitting here in my house. What could possibly go wrong, you right. know? And so I do think technology, that people aren't aware of how easy it is for boundaries to start to collapse. And you're right. If you have those underlying vulnerabilities and then you get online and you're just talking to people and it feels very innocent, it's not long before those boundaries start to totally collapse and you find yourself typing flirtatious things or slightly sexual things that, again, feel perfectly okay because I'm sitting here and I'm not I'm not actually engaged with you face to face. And it's really easy for that vulnerability to get triggered in the online environment.
It would be interesting to know in our current reality, how many emotional and physical affairs begin with some sort of expression of technology. So it's the texting, or it's like you said, the chatting feature in an app where I get to engage this person. There's still some distance because there's technology between me and them that creates kind of the chaos of closeness and separation at the very same time, which invites me to go further and further in the experience.
Exactly. And I always ask people, I had a client not too long ago who said, an old girlfriend contacted me over Facebook and we've just been chatting and it's been lovely to catch up. And my first question was, and does your wife know about this? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he said, no, I haven't told her. And that was like, you know, to help him unpack what was the reason you didn't mention that? Mm-hmm. And what were the, and he began to realize that there had been this slight flirtatiousness with the conversation that felt very innocent on one hand, but on another hand, he had this inner voice that said, I'm not going to share this with anybody. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's that idea that secrecy creates opportunity. Yes. And so if I'm doing something and people in my life don't know, it's actually becoming separate from the rest of my reality, that does increase my vulnerability. One other thing, as we come to an end, with technology, one of the stories I hear often are men that will go on dating apps and they don't actually connect with anyone, but they like to just scan and see who is there. And so that, again, brings that addiction energy. And so it's about maybe my intention is never to have an affair, and I can convince myself I'm not going to do that. But if I'm spending time and energy just seeing what might be available for me, that's a good indication that there's something unmanageable going on, even though it hasn't manifested itself in a relationship or in a sexual behavior, that there is a vulnerability that's being exposed.
I often think it's an indication of your loneliness and your feeling of emptiness inside. Mm-hmm. And if that fills you up, then that's a pseudo fill. Mm-hmm. And so sooner or later, it doesn't mean you'll engage in an affair. But my general take is that sooner or later, you will start to engage in behaviors, more and more behaviors that try to fill up that emptiness inside of you. And the solution really is to get help to figure out why is that emptiness there mm-hmm. in the first place. And, you know, going online and just knowing that it's there just in case I need it. Very few people can manage that over the long haul right. if they walk around with that big wound or that big feeling of emptiness inside. They're going to eventually look for something to fill that.
Mm-hmm. Window Absolutely. Shopping can be dangerous.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, as we conclude, let me just say for any of you that may be listening that are considering the possibility of coming to our men's workshop, as the director of the workshop, I often have those conversations with men. And so the idea is the workshop is for any man who, because of the choices he's making in the area of sexuality and relationships, he's creating chaos for himself and others. He's hurting himself and others. And on his own, he's been unable to stop. That is who the workshop is for. So if that is you, you have questions, be sure and look us up and see if there's a way that we might be able to support you.
You do that by visiting faithfulandtrue.com. Thanks for that, Greg. Yeah. And Elizabeth, thank you for joining us today. It's great to have you back on the podcast again and sharing your great words of wisdom for our listeners. For those that have been viewing or listening to this podcast, we thank you for doing so. If you haven't subscribed to the Faithful and True YouTube channel yet, please do and click like. We appreciate having that. And for you in this coming week, we pray that it's going to be a week for you that's filled with many blessings and with great vision.